Superbugs today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A Nevada woman died after being treated at hospitals in both India and the U.S. Her infection was resistant to more than 20 kinds of antibiotics. Welcome to the post-antibiotic era.
People think of it as something that might happen someday, but the reality is it is happening now, and it's going to happen more.
Plus, some Britons are bracing themselves for a long, painful exit from the European Union.
This is going to be 10 years of hard pounding. 10 years where many of the social difficulties that we're encountering will get worse rather than better.
And plans for a heterosexual pride march in Peru prompt this response.
Sorry, I'm confused because I thought every day was heterosexual pride day in Peru.
All that and more today on The World. Good to have you with us today. There are not that many stories we cover that could literally affect everyone. Climate change is one. Here's another. Antibiotic-resistant superbugs. Antibiotics are so good at fighting disease, we kind of take them for granted. You develop a bacterial infection, your doctor prescribes an antibiotic, and you're good to go. If it doesn't work, your doctor has more than 20 different antibiotics you can try. But what if none of them work? That's happening more and more often. Welcome to the scary new world of antibiotic-resistant superbugs. One of the latest cases is among the most worrying yet. A Nevada woman died after her infection proved resistant to 26 different antibiotics, every single one available in the U.S. Helen Branswell of the medical news site Stat has been covering that case. What do we know about this case so far and this woman? What happened to her?
We know what the CDC has published in a brief report last week. The woman had spent a lot of time in India. She had an accident of some sort and broke her right femur. Mm. Consequently, she developed an infection in that bone and in her hip, and she was in and out of hospital in India. At some point, she returned to Nevada and went into hospital in August there, and they tried to treat this infection, which had become systemic. And nothing they had worked, and she died. And testing later showed that, as you said, every drug that would have been available to U.S. doctors couldn't have cured this infection.
And why do you think this case has gotten so much attention, especially for health professionals who seem rather frightened by it?
Well, you know, this is happening all over the world on a somewhat regular basis. I mean, the current estimate is about 700,000 people a year die with or from infections that can't be cured. But it's not typically visible. This case was really nice and clear. They could see what was going on. They tested it. They have the evidence. So they published it as a cautionary tale, and it really is showing people this kind of thing can happen.
Yeah, and you say this is happening all over the world more and more. I mean, these drugs, these antibiotics changed the world. They ended a time when a bacterial infection was often a death sentence. Why are they starting to fail?
Well, I mean, the thing about bacteria is that they evolve, and they always had the capacity to evolve to the point where they could evade drugs. I mean, this is a natural cycle, but we hasten the cycle by the way we use antibiotics. For one thing, we use them when we don't actually have a bacterial infection. It's very common for people to go to a doctor with an upper respiratory tract infection and when they're feeling really crummy, and they probably have some viral infection, but they want something and the doctor gives them an antibiotic. It's not good medicine. And we need to stop doing that kind of thing. Another thing that we need to do, and this is a little bit in another direction, but we need to use these drugs more judiciously in agricultural production. They're used extensively in the production of animals raised for meat. So clearly steps have to be taken to limit that.
What about new drugs? I mean, there's hundreds of billions of dollars in big pharma. Is it hard to come up with new antibiotics?
The low-hanging fruit has been picked, and people have been searching for new antibiotics, but it's harder to come up with them. Once you get them, the problem is you need for those drugs essentially not to be used. So when you think about the way pharma typically works, they develop a drug and then they want to sell as much of it as possible. Mm. And what the world needs them to do is develop a drug and then have everyone use it as sparingly as possible to prolong its utility. So, you know, people who are looking at the problem of antibiotic resistance have been talking about finding other ways to incentivize industry to do this crucial work.
So if new antibiotics may not be the ideal answer to antibiotic resistance, what else can governments and doctors and regular folks like us do?
Well, we can use them only when we need them. We can buy meat that hasn't been raised with antibiotics. We can make it clear through our actions and our purchasing that we take this seriously and we want our governments to too.
The woman who died in Nevada, as you said, she'd been hospitalized several times in India, and doctors and researchers are suggesting patients be more rigorous about giving their healthcare providers their travel histories. Make the connection.
Well, some places, and India is among them, have higher rates of some of these really multi-drug resistant bacteria than others. And in some countries, you can buy antibiotics over the counter. So that's fueling the development of resistance. So doctors need to know your travel history because it will tell them things that they might be on the lookout for, essentially.
Any lessons that you think we should take from the case of this one unfortunate woman in Nevada?
That this isn't theoretical. You know, people have been talking about a post-antibiotic era for a while, and it sounds really scary. And I think people think of it as something that might happen someday. But the reality is, it is happening now, and it's going to happen more. And so when you think about a lot of the medical procedures that have been developed, for instance, hip replacements, cardiac bypass surgery, even, you know, safe cesarean section births. I mean, a lot of these procedures may become too dangerous to do if we don't get this under control.
Helen Branswell with the medical news site Stat. She's been covering the case of a Nevada woman who died after her infection proved resistant to every single antibiotic available in the U.S. Helen, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Across the Atlantic, all eyes and ears were on British Prime Minister Theresa May today. She gave a speech on her Brexit plans, i.e. how the U.K. is actually going to leave the European Union, as British voters decided in last year's referendum. People listened intently to that speech all over Europe, including at the elite Global Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland.
You know, I gathered around a few television screens when she gave her big speech about how she would take the UK out of the European Union. And she was giving that speech from London, but she'll be turning up in Davos on Thursday to give a very similar speech. And I don't think that too many people were very impressed with her speech today.
Not in Davos, anyway. More on that later. First, let's hear more about what Theresa May actually said today. The Prime Minister envisioned what she called a clean break with the European Union, and that includes leaving Europe's common economic market completely and then negotiating a new trade agreement with the continent. Will Hutton is a former editor-in-chief of the Observer newspaper. He says May's speech was a big moment for Britain and Europe.
It's the most important speech that she's made as prime minister and one of the most important speeches made by any British prime minister since 1945. And the reason why not only people in Davos, but actually many people in Britain and Europe are so unhappy is this is taking a step backwards. The European Union has got many imperfections. Everybody knows that. It needs to kind of refine its purpose. But it is a system for 28 countries in Europe, neighbors of each other, working together to find common solutions in our continent. If Texas or California were to leave the United States of America, everyone in the States would be disconcerted, and so actually would all America's partners. That, in effect, is what's happening here. We're going back, and the impact on trade, finance, economy, society, culture, tensions between European countries are all up in the air and all are likely to be bad rather than good.
It is a system, though, that British voters apparently don't like and which Theresa May seems situated to get out of. Which of her points struck you most?
Where do I begin? She's heading towards trying to sever relationships completely with the European Union. and then reforge your relationship as if a divorce hasn't taken place. This is going to be 10 years of hard pounding, 10 years in which the country in which I live is going to grow very much more slowly than it would have done otherwise, where many of the social difficulties that we're encountering will get worse rather than better. And if I felt it was for a great and glorious future, you'd feel happy. But you know it's backward. And you know that this backward step is going to cause a lot of pain. And that's essentially what gave me the discomfort hearing her. This was not the language of a politician trying to negotiate, do a deal, come to a compromise that works for both sides. This was a kind of you can go F off, I mean, to speak the vernacular, and then we'll try and remake the deal once I've F'd off. That's no way, I think, for a nation state in our times to behave.
Almost sounds like you're talking about the Affordable Care Act that Republicans in this country are trying to repeal. It's like, we don't have a plan yet, but when we do, we'll tell you about it.
Well, at least it's only the Affordable Care Act, and, you know, it has a limit, and you can revisit it if there's a different kind of a presidential candidate in 4 years' time, all of that. This is forever. What I'm talking about in Britain is forever. There's no way back. There's no way of revising it. And that's because a referendum, you know, you don't use referenda in the United States, and they're only used in a few countries in Europe, and very, very carefully, because they are such dangerous things. They're a snapshot of opinion at a moment in time, and that opinion can change a year later, but you've got no mechanism of unraveling the decision that you took, because they're for all time. It's not like a parliamentary democracy or the system you've got in the States, where periodically 2, 4 years, 5 years, you have a fresh party who comes in and forms a fresh government, and you can remake things and undo things that have been undone and vice versa. This is for, and it's only been done on a tiny, tiny majority of 700,000 votes for such a seismic thing.
So, Will, Prime Minister May will be in Davos, Switzerland later this week to deliver essentially the same speech to people who adore globalization. What do you think the people in Davos worry about when they look into the future and they see Theresa May, you know, maybe making bilateral trade deals with Donald Trump?
Well, I think this is the breakdown of the international order. I mean, Donald Trump and the United States are much more important in this respect than Theresa May. The world has prospered for the last 50 years because trade has increased. Trade. You get growth with trade. And what Donald Trump is going to do is say, we don't want to live in that world anymore. We want to cut individual deals, individual countries. That may mean there'll be less trade, but the trade there is will be advantageous to Midwestern states in America. Maybe, maybe not, but he's going to try. Mm. And the rest of you can go hang. Mrs. May and Britain are going the same direction. And they're saying to the Europeans, you know, openness and trade are not what we're about. We're about looking after number one. And the lesson of history is very, very clear. From 1929 to 1939, we looked after number one. It ended in international conflict, tension, and war. And we're entering a world in which everyone's looking after number one. The trouble is, the people in Davos are right to believe in trade and right to believe in globalization. But actually, they're also the fat cats. They're the least good people to make the case for this. And that is actually the problem of our times, that these elites that actually have done so well out of the globalization and trade and have grown very fat and prosperous are not good advocates of the system. And they're now reaping the whirlwind. And we're all going to share that whirlwind with them.
Will Hutton, a former editor-in-chief of the Observer newspaper, now a columnist there. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're with the world. Every year, the picturesque alpine resort town of Davos, Switzerland, welcomes some pretty high-profile visitors. Political and economic leaders from all over the globe gather there for the World Economic Forum. This year, a new edition. For the first time, a Chinese head of state is at the forum, and he arrived today with a few advisors.
The motorcade today for the president was between 26 and 30 cars long. I actually lost count. Suffice to say, it was a very big presence in a small mountainside village.
That's Politico's Ryan Heath describing Chinese President Xi Jinping's arrival in Davos. Heath says that Xi wowed everyone when the forum opened today.
The audience was lapping it up when he said that protectionism was like locking yourself in a dark room. You could keep out the nasty weather elements, but you also blocked out air and light. He mounted a very strong defense of economic globalization as well, and essentially said that, yes, there are defects. Yes, there are victims of globalization, but you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater just because there are problems along the way. And I think that was music to the ears of this international crowd in Davos.
I mean, one person on Twitter summed up Xi's comments on the global economy: no new growth drivers, bad global governance, and growing inequality. He kind of sounds like a Chinese Bernie Sanders. And we know how Bernie Sanders felt about globalization. Not good.
Well, what I thought was, if you closed your eyes, he sounded like a European social democrat. So you really felt that it was a deliberate attempt to be the opposite of Donald Trump. Every word was one that had been carefully calibrated. He threw in lots of references to please the audience, whether it was quoting Dickens or nice Chinese proverbs that everybody could relate to, and some of his own jokes. And he really showed that there is another way to communicate with power compared to what we've been hearing a lot of from the incoming U.S. administration.
So maybe Xi Jinping doesn't want China to be the flag bearer for globalization, but I would have a hard time believing he doesn't want China to be the global economic leader. How does Xi Jinping position China within all these other elites gathered in Davos?
The key phrase for me there is he said, we're not jealous of other people's successes. And I think what he was trying to say there was that Donald Trump is sort of putting up barriers, either mental or physical, around the United States in an attempt to slow down the train of globalization. And what President Xi was saying was the opposite in a sense, which was like, we'll let everybody else join the train. Come and join our side rather than the side you're used to being on, which is the United States.
So what would you say is the kind of impact the Chinese are hoping to make in Davos by the time they leave?
I think they're trying to reassure people that they're reliable partners in this post-United States world order. So I think we've had a clear sense that the U.S. has been that real singular leader of the world since 1989. And I think we're either moving to a phase where it's multipolar, where there are several leadership countries, including China, or where nobody's really a leader anymore. And so China is trying to show that they are a practical force for good. Now, of course, they don't want too many questions asked about how is that democracy project going and how are individual human rights. But the Chinese do have a lot of economic successes. They have been successful in reducing poverty.
Is that code for we may be more reliable than, you know, Trump USA?
I absolutely think so. And the other problem that the people at Davos have been struggling with is that some leaders don't really want to be seen amongst them anymore. You know, if you are facing an election this year, it's not a great look to turn up with billionaire bankers and guzzle champagne all week long. So to some extent, the crowd here has to take what they can get. And in this case, it happens to be one of the two most powerful people on the planet.
Politico senior EU correspondent Ryan Heath speaking with us from Davos. Thanks very much, Ryan.
Thank you.
If you're hip to happenings in Peru, you may have seen on Facebook an event scheduled for today in Lima, a march for heterosexual pride. It's been getting a lot of attention online, not all wanted attention, and it's become the butt of a few jokes as well. The World's Maria Muriel is more dialed into this than I am. Maria, tell us about this march.
Hey, Marco. This march is actually a spin-off of the original march, which on Facebook had thousands of RSVPs and also thousands of really raunchy jokes using the trademark Peruvian humor and innuendo to talk about homosexual sex. However, that original march for heterosexual pride was canceled because it got so many trolley comments. And this spinoff that is up today is just a joke so that people can continue to make fun of the idea. So basically, it's gotten mostly negative attention.
So what was the original idea? Because, I mean, do heterosexuals need to assert their rights?
Right. So the original idea was to have a march for heterosexual pride in response to a march for LGBT pride that happened in Lima last July. And actually, now that you mention it, yeah, lots of people were pointing that out, including Congressman Alberto de Belaunde, who said, sorry, I'm confused about the date of this event because I thought every day was heterosexual pride day in Peru.
Interesting. So the LGBT parade, was that kind of controversial?
Yeah. You know, Peru is a really conservative, staunchly Catholic nation. And I grew up there. I was born there. So the whole time that I was living there, I knew, you know, homosexuality as a bad thing. That's kind of the way that mainstream society views it. So what's surprising to me is not just that there's an LGBT rights movement that's been blossoming over the past year, and also a women's right movement, but actually that people like this congressman, De Belaunde, are sticking up for these progressive, socially progressive movements in Peru. That's really surprising to me.
So it sounds like Peru is slowly changing its attitudes, despite the fact that it's a staunchly Catholic country.
Right. It would appear so. And Peru is surrounded by countries like Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, you know, Argentina, which is a fairly progressive Latin American country. And, you know, all of those have at least a recognition of same-sex marriage or civil unions. Peru does not. And it's actually, it's handling its own case of same-sex marriage. Mm. The same congressman, Alberto de Belaunde, has been a proponent of civil unions in Peru. And recently, a court ruled in Peru to recognize a same-sex union.
So is the divide in Peru, can we attribute it all to religion, or are there other factors at play?
Well, no, I don't think we can attribute it all to religion. And I think a lot of this backlash toward LGBT and socially progressive issues is coming probably from a religious place. This congressman that I'm mentioning is a part of the ruling party of Peru, the party of President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski. And he is viewed as a man having lots of ties to the U.S. He's very Americanized. He's sort of seen as maybe even more liberal by a lot of people. So there's the religious aspect, and then there's a sort of nationalist bend that's like, no, this guy is too far left. We don't like it. And there's a lot of division right now between the left and the right in Peru.
So how much of these attitudes in Peru are actually changing right now?
Well, it seems like, again, surprisingly, some of it is changing. And it seems like at least some of it is coming from government agencies. Like I said, this congressman who was opposed to the hetero pride march, Alberto de Belaunde, he is also a supporter of Peru's civil union proposal. I should also mention that the Ministry of Education just proposed a new curriculum that encourages gender equality. And some people are protesting this because they see it as encouraging sort of non-traditional gender norms. And some even go so far as saying that this curriculum is going to encourage homosexuality. And there's lots of parents that are having this sort of not in my backyard moment where they're like, don't mess with our children. You know, don't teach, boys have to be boys and girls have to be girls. Don't teach them otherwise. And, you know, people on the other side are like, that's not what we're doing. We're trying to make it so that girls have the same access to education as boys do. And that's a lot of, I just see, you know, being far away, I see a lot of divisive rhetoric happening in Peru.
The World's Maria Muriel, thanks for joining us and telling us about this.
Thank you, Marco.
You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. After more than 2 years, the search for a missing passenger jet has been suspended. But some argue the search needs to start again.
The first primary purpose of an investigation is to make sure it doesn't happen again. And we have no clue what caused this to happen. No clue at all.
The ongoing mystery of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So after more than 2 years of searching and countless hours scouring huge areas of the ocean floor, it is still an unsolved mystery. The search for the missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 was suspended today. The Boeing 777 disappeared back in March of 2014 en route from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people on board. Malaysia, Australia, and China have spent over $160 million trying to locate the plane. They've come up empty-handed, but some would argue the search should continue. Clive Irving has been writing about the investigation for the Daily Beast.
I think it's important to note that they didn't say the search had been closed down. They said it had been suspended. That's a very loaded word in this context because, in fact, only in December, Australian scientists came up with a much more accurate, they think, formula for where the plane is, and that was placing it about 100 or so miles north of the present search area. And in fact, in the last week, the one last search vessel was moved up into that new area and was actually doing mapping of the ocean floor, which would be a necessary first step to a new search. So it ought to be unacceptable in this day and age that this wreck is left undiscovered forever. That would be unacceptable. One reason is plane went down. So I think behind the scenes, although they're not saying this at the moment, there's a huge discussion going on about whether they're going to come up with the money to start a new search.
All right, but $160 million is still a lot of money. And obviously,
well, I don't know. In relation to 239 people's lives and being able to explain how they died, in modern money, I don't think it's a lot of money. I think it ought to be forthcoming.
And so you believe there are strong reasons to continue the search operation?
Yes, I do. And I think it will continue eventually.
So take us back to why the search area has been moved, because there it was some tantalizing bits of evidence. Remind us what those were and why it was able to lead investigators to a new area, but not enough to find the plane itself.
Well, what they've done is they've taken one of the first piece of wreckage to turn up was a thing called a flaperon, which is an essential part of the controls of the plane on the wing, and that was more or less intact. And what they've done is to make reproductions of that flaperon, and they put them into the ocean and carried out tests to see their speed of travel, how they would be affected by wind and current and so on. And that's one of the calculations that's gone into fixing this new area. And another essential piece of wreckage that was found was a part of a wing flap. And they were able to tell from that wing flap that the flap had not been deployed as the plane hit the water. In other words, that firmly established that no human being was in control of this plane when it went into the ocean. And that, in turn, means that it was flying on autopilot in this so-called zombie period of the flight when no human contact was evident from the plane for 5 hours and 40 minutes. That's the most spooky part of the whole story. So having the wreckage has been much more instructive than anything they found underwater, because they haven't found basically anything underwater. But there are over 20 pieces of wreckage now that have washed up in the Western Indian Ocean, and they've all had a story to tell, and it's a pretty instructive and powerful story. First, that the plane wasn't piloted when it went down. The second, from the tracing these larger pieces back to the point of origin, they've really helped to make a much more accurate calculation. It's like when sciences progress in war under the pressure cooker heat of a war. This science has been greatly advanced. The technology has been greatly pushed forward by the pressure of the search.
There was a family member of one of the passengers on the plane who also said that without understanding what happened to the plane, there's a good chance that this could happen in the future. Do you agree with
that? Yeah, that's true of any air accident. You have to find out what caused it, because the first primary purpose of an investigation is to make sure it doesn't happen again. And we have no clue what caused this to happen, no clue at all.
What is your most plausible theory about what happened to MH370?
Well, it has all the symptoms of something called hypoxia, where the crew and the passengers all pass out for lack of oxygen. If I was Sherlock Holmes and looking at the single most convincing piece of circumstantial evidence, that would be it. Something caused a lack of air pressure in the plane, a sudden lack of air pressure. In technical terms, to my mind, that's the only plausible theory. But what caused that lack of pressure is what we have to find.
Clive Irving writes for the Daily Beast about aviation. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
A lot of Americans are concerned, to put it mildly, about the alleged Russian attempt to influence the election here last year. U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded with a high degree of confidence that Russia acted to discredit Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump. They described it as a classic influence campaign that included everything from hacking emails to publishing fake news. Completely unprecedented, if they're right. But I was surprised to learn today about another time when a foreign power tried to sway a U.S. election. Apparently, Britain and Germany both meddled in our affairs back in 1940. The world's history guy Chris Wolfe has been on the case. What happened here, Chris?
Well, Marco, it turns out the model for a classic influence campaign, as the CIA likes to call it, was established by the Brits in 1940. I must give credit here to Politico's Steve Usdin for breaking this story yesterday. The Brits used wiretaps to get dirt, recruited journalists to plant favourable stories, invented fake stories, used dirty tricks to try to destroy opponents, and they funded and coordinated pro-British activist groups.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. What was the goal of all this?
Well, obviously, World War II began in Europe in 1939. By June of 1940, Britain was fighting alone against Nazi Germany. So both London and Berlin realized that only really US intervention could change the course of the war in the UK's favor. So both set out to influence the US election. Now, Winston Churchill had just become Prime Minister in May, and he hired this freelance agent, William Stevenson, to head up this new North America operation. Now, he set up shop on June 21st, 1940, in the Rockefeller Center in New York, room 3603,
as
a group he called British Security Coordination.
So what did they actually do?
At the time, obviously, the Democratic candidate, FDR, was running again. He obviously favoured helping Britain as much as America could in accordance with its neutrality laws. But Congress and much of public opinion was still, like, strongly isolationist. So the Brits thought FDR was a safe bet, so they tried to hedge their bets by trying to manipulate the Republican nomination. Only one candidate for the Republicans, a guy called Wendell Willkie, favoured intervention. The others were all pro-isolationist. And he went into the convention as the complete underdog. Then a poll came out from a group called Market Analysis, Inc., which said that 60% of the Republican delegates favoured helping the UK. The findings were picked up and run by none other than the New York Herald. And an influential syndicated columnist, a conservative, William Allen White, picked up the story and wrote that clearly now all the other candidates are out of touch with the grassroots of the party. And blow me down if Willkie doesn't win the nomination. It turns out the polling company was a complete British front. They did many polls during the war. All of them favoured intervention. All of them were completely made up. Now, Willkie had his own merits, but, you know, the result really astonished the country and the party.
Yes, so that sounds like manipulation. What about dirty tricks? Did Great Britain get into any of that?
Absolutely. They specifically targeted politicians to try and bring them down, to try and like shift the balance of power in Congress. In particular, one Republican, a guy called Hamilton Fish of New York, was targeted. And the quote in the official history is, "to put the fear of God into every isolationist senator and congressman in the country." So they funded his opponents. They published pamphlets suggesting he was pro-Hitler. They released a false photo of Congressman Fish with the head of the pro-Nazi German-American Bund. They planted stories that he was getting financial aid from Germany. They're doing everything they could to discredit his re-election. In other dirty tricks, they wiretapped the French embassy and used a honey trap to get intelligence out of French diplomats about pro-German activities. And these stories were then released and planted in the media through the agents, through the journalists that the Brits had recruited to work directly for them.
I've got enormous faith in you, Chris, but how do we know all of this is true?
Well, the boss, the guy I mentioned, William Stevenson, actually was a Canadian, knew that after the war, when they were being disbanded, that this would be consigned to oblivion. So he commissioned a history to be written by some of his former agents for posterity. Now, this was kind of a standard practice for these dodgy operations that the Brits would do now and then. And the secret history of British intelligence in the Americas, 1940-45, came out. And actually, I think listeners may recognize one of the names of the authors, one of the agents, a guy called Roald Dahl,
Of course,
was working
yes.
for Stevenson, as, of course, was Ian Fleming and Noel Coward.
Wow. Triumvirate.
Exactly.
FDR was reelected in 1940 and again in 44. Can we attribute that to the Brits?
You know, I think the jury is out about really how successful the influence campaign was. For example, Hamilton Fish, the Republican that they targeted in New York, actually won re-election in 1940, albeit with a reduced majority. And even though FDR got in, his position was his own. You know, that wasn't really something to be manipulated. But Congress and public opinion was still stridently isolationist right up until the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. So I think the jury is out on just quite how successful the British campaign was. But it's clearly better than the Germans, which was exposed and discredited.
There was One Man History Desk, Chris Wolfe. Thanks for telling us about this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Donald Trump's inauguration is 3 days away, and after he's sworn in, President Trump will stroll from the U.S. Capitol to his new home, the White House. Parading down those 1.8 miles of Pennsylvania Avenue dates back to Thomas Jefferson's second inauguration in 1805. Pennsylvania Avenue has changed a lot since then, even recently. It now has a dedicated center lane just for cyclists. The World's Jason Margolis rode the inaugural route and has our story.
Last week, I gathered with about 30 people in front of the U.S. Capitol. Tommy Wells directs the City of Washington's Department of Energy and the Environment.
We're about to ride on America's Boulevard. We're about to ride on Pennsylvania Avenue. That's how I rode to work every day. It was almost 7 to 8 lanes wide and the largest sidewalks you'll find in any city and no place for bicycles. And it really was like an extreme sport each morning coming through here and then launching myself down Pennsylvania Avenue to be sure I didn't get hit.
He doesn't worry about that today. A bike lane down the center of Pennsylvania Avenue was installed in 2010.
And I think one of the greatest things for a lot of us in D.C. that was a crowning achievement is when the previous or the current president, Barack Obama, when you have the inauguration and the president traditionally gets out of the car and walks, I was cheering seeing that he was walking down our bike lanes, that America saw bike lanes.
All right, folks, we're going to head out in 1 minute once I make sure that everybody's off the sidewalk.
We got on our bikes and headed toward the White House. D.C. city officials have worked with urban planners from Denmark to build up the city's cycling infrastructure and culture. Today, nearly 5% of commuters in D.C. bike to work. 15 years ago, that number was less than 1%. The city still has a ways to go, though, says the Danish ambassador to the U.S., Lars Loos. He held my microphone as we cycled.
To be honest, it's not as good as Copenhagen. But it's pretty good, I mean, compared to other capitals around the world where I've done some biking, it's pretty good, and it's getting better by the day.
On Pennsylvania Avenue, we rode down the center, separated from cars and trucks by lines of paint and 3-foot-tall plastic posts. Normally, there are small rubber barriers here, but those were temporarily removed for the inaugural parade. Still, I thought it was great. But Loos says Washington's cycling paths don't rise to Danish standards.
In Denmark, we have elevated bike lanes, so which is much more secure, much more safe than just having paint on the road. So that makes a difference.
Of course, that's expensive, and a lot of people don't want more cycling infrastructure. Bike lanes can take real estate away from cars, and cyclists can be a menace on the roads. But give D.C. some more time. Even Copenhagen, one of the world's greatest cycling cities, took decades to become what it is today.
In Copenhagen, you actually have 63% of the members of parliament using their bike every day when they go to work.
Loos says seeing elected officials on a bike, that makes a difference. George W. Bush was an avid mountain biker. Barack Obama has been photographed biking on vacation many times. We don't know much about Donald Trump's cycling tastes. He did own a U.S. bike race in the 1980s called the Tour de Trump. He said it would rival the Tour de France, but it only lasted 2 years. At the time, this is what he told NBC Sports when asked about the last time he got on a bike.
That's a tough question. That was many, many years ago. But I would say when I was about 7 or 8 years old was probably about it.
Let's get back to my ride along Pennsylvania Avenue.
Can you cycle with one hand?
No problem.
Okay, that's so Klaus Bondum, director of the Danish Cyclist Federation in Copenhagen, who also deftly held my microphone as we rode. He says more bikes on the road means less pollution, fewer greenhouse gases emitted, and less traffic, and improved health for cyclists.
We have calculations in Denmark stating that for every kilometer we exchange the car with the bicycle, we actually save the Danish society for around $1 in prolonged life and improved health effects.
President-elect Trump has spoken a lot about improving transportation infrastructure in his first 100 days in office, but Bondum fears that might mean emphasizing the car.
We see what happens and hope for the best.
Trump really hasn't said anything recently about cycling other than to ridicule Secretary of State John Kerry for breaking his leg after falling off his bike in 2015. Shortly after Kerry's accident, Trump vowed he'd stay away from cycling if elected president. For The World, Jason Margolis, Washington.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. This is a story about the kind of services that spring up to help refugees and victims of war. In Jordan, women's health centers are opening up to serve some of the hundreds of thousands of Syrians who are living there now. But these centers are also providing a service for Jordanian women who lack access to care. Venetia Rainey went to visit one of these centers in Deir Allah.
Children chase each other through the corridors as their mothers catch up on the latest news. This is one of a handful of dedicated women's centers in eastern Jordan, and the place is busy. The Institute for Family Health opened a little more than 3 years ago to serve Syrian refugees here in Deir Allah, one of the poorest parts of Jordan. It offers family planning, pre- and postnatal care, and checkups for kids, as well as counselling and support for victims of domestic violence. 31-year-old Noor is a regular here.
In all honesty, after leaving Syria, I was pretty shaken up. I didn't feel able to open up and share anything with anyone. At first, I used to come here to see the gynecologist. But after I saw how well I was treated, I started seeing the psychologist, too.
Noor fled to Jordan with her husband and daughter 4 years ago after their house in Deraa was bombed. But as her husband struggled to find work in Jordan, their financial situation became desperate. That's when he began to take his frustrations out on his family.
The first year we were here, there were so many arguments at home that it got to the point where we were separated for a bit. I just couldn't take it anymore. I had to leave the house. He hits and he breaks. He attacks whatever's in his path, whether it's me or my kids.
Iman Aladi is one of the counsellors here at the centre. She says they see about 800 patients a month, roughly half of them victims of domestic violence. Aladi helps them come up with coping strategies and ways to diffuse tense situations with their husbands. The centre also does something else. It gives women like Noor an excuse to get out of the house.
Sometimes when you socialise with other people, you feel much better than you would if you stayed at home.
This women's centre was set up for Syrians with funding from the UN Population Fund, but it's become a haven for Jordanian women as well. One in three Jordanian women has experienced some form of violence at the hands of their spouse, according to a 2012 government survey, but only half of them ever seek any help. That may be because there aren't many services for women outside of the capital, something that is now changing due to funding for the Syrian crisis. One of the classes offered here is origami folding. It's not exactly therapy, but it does give the women a chance to relax and be creative. Mariam is a 39-year-old Jordanian who comes to the centre for support. Like Noor, she's a victim of domestic abuse.
It was very hard. I would have liked to have brought my husband here for counselling too. But you know how men can be, the way they think.
She tells me her relationship with her husband hasn't changed exactly since she started coming here, but she has. Just the chance to talk with other women in her situation has really helped. The Institute for Family Health had a clinic in Deir Ella back in the 90s, but it closed, not for lack of demand, but lack of funding. If it hadn't been for the money now being funneled into Jordan to respond to the Syrian refugee crisis, says Iman Aladi, this new centre would never have opened.
Jordanian women in this area used to have to go to a hospital far away and wait a long time just to get an ultrasound. Even then, sometimes they'd get it, sometimes they wouldn't. The only other option was an expensive private doctor here, which isn't affordable for most. Now we can offer this as a free service to all the women in the area.
The centre is one of 15 safe spaces for women that the UN has opened in Jordan in the past 5 years. It's possible that the money for these centres will dry up once Syria's refugee crisis is over, but it doesn't seem as if that will happen anytime soon. For the World, Venetia Rainey, Deir Allah, Jordan.
Women's health, also an important issue for singer Noura Mintsemali, breast cancer awareness specifically. Noura Mintsemali is from Mauritania in West Africa, and she wants to make sure women, especially women in Africa, get their annual screenings. Semali helps to raise awareness through a song. It's called Arbina, and it's also the title of her latest album.
Arbina is a name for God, and the song Arbina speaks about breast cancer and carries a message to women to get early screenings for breast cancer. This is an illness that kills a lot of women in the world. It took the life of my mother, so it's a message to all women to take cancer screening very seriously and quickly. I've wanted to write about this subject for a long time, ever since I was with my mother and saw what she was going through with her treatment. I was living it with her. I went with her to the pharmacy to buy expensive medications. I was with her in the hospital. I identify with women who are going through this.
Even when she sings about other things, it's often personal for Noura Mintsemali. She says there's always a connection.
Every subject that I sing about is inspired by something I feel personally. There are songs about love, about public health, about youth, peace and unity. The only subject I don't sing about is politics.
She says music is above politics, which is hard to process when you consider she sings about public health and peace and unity. Maybe she feels being a political singer is too much of a burden. Peace was definitely on her mind last summer at the Glastonbury Festival in the UK. Noura Mintsemali performed her song Risha with members of the Syrian National Orchestra. Just a chance, perhaps, for musicians to overcome war and play together. Music from Mauritania's Noura Mintsemali brings our show to a close today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.